This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. He's known as the father of the global green building movement. In fact, David Gottfried's work has impacted the global building industry more than almost any other. The Cincinnati Zoo's Thane Maynard has a conversation with him later in the show. But first, the Affordable Care Act has drastically changed the way businesses shop for, fund, and provide health insurance to their employees. And both small and large businesses face challenges in meeting the measuring, monitoring, and reporting requirements of the ACA. Here to discuss what employers should be doing to stay in compliance with the law are Jolie Havens, partner with Voorhees, Sater, Seymour, and Pease, Horan Vice President of Employee Benefits Services, Valerie Bogdan-Powers, and David Whaley, partner at Dinsmore & Shule. Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for joining me. Good afternoon.
Thanks.
And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Jolie, most of the attention that's been on the state and the federal health exchanges, but how much of complying with the Affordable Care Act is going to fall on businesses, especially since for many people, their job's their primary source for health insurance?
A considerable amount, actually falls to businesses. I mean, they have some very important decisions to make regarding what coverage they are going to offer. That, for most businesses, is not only a financial decision, but also one that is rooted in, you know, culture, recruiting, overall employee morale. So once you make the decision as to what coverage you are going to provide and what impact that will have under the employer mandate, then, as you said at the top of the show, we now have some new reporting requirements that will come into play for coverage provided in 2015. The reporting will be done in 2016. So in addition to implementing an employer's compliance strategy in 2015 with respect to the employer mandate, they also have to begin tracking some information, which will then be reported to the government and participants and will effectively enable the government to enforce the employer mandate as well as the individual coverage mandate.
Valerie, for businesses, where does the Affordable Care Act rank on their scale of concerns and issues?
Very high. Healthcare in general is usually the second line item in a budget for a company. And so as a result, this has just exacerbated the amount of work that needs to happen. So you have staffs that need to think about what's their, as Jolie said, the culture of what they're going to offer, and then the actual execution. So who's going to do this reporting? Where are the man hours to make sure you've track the right eligible employees, that you've tracked people's hours to make sure that you are not in a state where you're going to get fines or penalties because you haven't offered to the right amount of people. And then, again, the reporting, it's not even fully defined. It's mostly defined by the government right now. And so they have to start thinking about collecting data and information on guidance, not final regulations from the IRS. And so as they think about that and tapping into payroll companies in different places, it's a lot of work to even understand how to do it, not just doing it.
It sounds, David, like it's almost a moving target, isn't it?
Yeah, the challenge that we really end up seeing is that functionally we've created almost what I'm referring to as a healthcare W-2. And so what it is you're delivering this functional healthcare W-2 to functionally every one of your employees, telling them what coverage they had, how much that coverage cost, to see if they can figure out whether or not they're eligible for a subsidy in the exchange. So basically, we have this large tax reporting requirement that almost doubles the amount of communication from an employer to an employee about tax liability, and it's going out on that same time frame and basis. We're looking at 2016 for reporting for 2015 purposes, but as Valerie mentioned, all of that information for 2016's reporting on 2015 purposes needs to be collected during 2015. And so as we collect that during 2015 here at the end of 2014, we have to actually build processes and implement procedures to collect the information, to put it in a report, to make sure that we can deliver that at the beginning of 2016.
Wow.
And you know,
I'm lost already.
And one of the hardest parts about that is, if you remember, when we were here last year, we talked about the employer part of the mandate got delayed until January 15. So employers are just looking at how they're going to comply with offering health care, who they're going to offer health care to for this year. And now on top of that, you have reporting that really puts a double whammy in what they need to be doing in a very short time frame.
Julia, what size does a business have to be to fall under the ACA requirements?
Well, there are a variety of requirements, and unfortunately, making this all the more complex, a variety of different size calculations that come into play depending on what exactly you're talking about in terms of the ACA requirement. But for purposes of what we're talking about today, an applicable large employer is 50 or more full-time or full-time equivalent employees. So you look at your number of full-time employees using the 30-hour full-time standard that we have under the ACA, and then you also have to aggregate together the hours of your part-timers and divide that by full-time hours to effectively figure out how many FTEs you have. So in theory, you could have an employer that had well less than 50 full-time employees, but maybe had several part-timers, and they would still be considered an applicable large employer for purposes of the mandate and certain aspects of the reporting.
Have we had companies that have reduced their staffs to get under that 50 number?
I have not seen, at least with respect to the clients that I'm working with, a major staff reduction. I mean, there has been a lot of talk in the media regarding some larger national employers that have been at least piloting, you know, part-time workforces and things like that. And what that goes to is it doesn't necessarily change size. Your size is what your size is when you aggregate all of the hours together. But the employer mandate does not require that you provide coverage to part-time employees. So even if you are an applicable large employer, if all of your employees are part-time, then there would not be the requirement to provide coverage to them. And you've seen that a lot in the, you know, restaurant industry, for example. I've seen it also to some degree with retailers and hospitality as well.
Are existing plans grandfathered?
That's
is that the $64,000 question?
You know, what it means to be grandfathered is actually a very narrow standard, and it ties into the plan that you had in place when the ACA was enacted March 23rd, 2010. And in order to maintain grandfathered status, there are only very few changes that can be made to your plan going forward. And the importance of grandfathered status, I know we talked about this a bit when we were on before, is that there is a single layer of mandates that applies to all plans, and then there is an additional layer of mandates that will apply to a plan that is non-grandfathered, meaning it has had changes since that 2010 date so substantial that the government deems it to no longer be the same plan. The interesting part about that, though, is it's primarily geared toward changes in cost sharing and increasing expenses for participants. And as I said, there is a very, very small bandwidth there that allows employer changes while still maintaining grandfathered status. The vast majority of plans that we see, as well as plans, you know, nationally, have no longer maintained grandfathered status because it simply isn't feasible year over year for the employer to be in the position of absorbing all of those costs and only passing along a very, very small amount to participants.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can also email talk@wvxu.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Melissa commented on Facebook, the ACA is now back in the Supreme Court. Legally, can Republicans drag this through again? And thank you for the question, Melissa. And though what she is talking about really deals with more legal and political issues, what's your perspective on that, David and Valerie?
Yeah, it's really interesting that the case that the Supreme Court is again taking up the Affordable Care Act. And it's a very small area that the Supreme Court has been asked to take up and look at, but it has a very, very broad potential implication. Specifically, they're asking whether or not the tax subsidies that are available to individuals that are between 100 and 400% of the federal poverty line are available when an individual lives in a state that has a federally run exchange. The statute's not perfectly clear with respect to the ability to utilize that tax subsidy in a state that has a federally run exchange, and the Supreme Court's been asked to look at this decision. Now, the challenge is, as Jolie mentioned, is the penalties for an employer are functionally based on whether or not your employees can get a subsidy. So if you, employer, happen to be in a state that has a federally run exchange, and you have no employees that live in a state that has a state-run exchange, you have no fear of penalties because your people, your employees, can't get to a subsidy. And if they can't get to a subsidy, you don't have a coverage mandate. So what we start to see is that the only people that will run to the exchange and get coverage are the very sick. And if the only people that get coverage are the very sick, the system begins to fall apart. And so it's a very interesting question the Supreme Court's been asked to hear. It'll be really intriguing to see what the outgrowth of it is. And the timing of the Supreme Court taking the case was really unusual there wasn't a direct circuit split that would normally rise to the level to see the Supreme Court walk in and decide the question. And so it was an unusual timing that they actually took up the case, which leads to this question of, is there a political context or question? And I don't think the answer is probably it's just a statutory interpretation question to the Supreme Court.
Right. And I think what you're going to see, everyone keeps asking us, our employers, what's happened with the elections? And what we will tell our employers is you need to follow the law as it's stated today. You need to comply with the law. And you're going to see little areas chipped away. And some of those chips, as David points out, may have broader implications and some may not. And so that's what, as we advise our clients, that's the direction and advice we provide.
Yeah. And my biggest concern is the same thing we had a little bit of during the first Supreme Court hearing. And the first Supreme Court hearing was a level of a lot of employers deciding, I'm not going to deal with this. I'm going to wait until the Supreme Court rules because I think the Supreme Court's going to say that this is unconstitutional. I fear that if we get to January 30th this year with an employer who's waiting for something of that likelihood, they're going to be behind an eight ball with respect to solving their problems that they need to solve for providing coverage to enough employees to avoid penalties.
Absolutely. And in this coming year, employers, about 80% of people get their insurance through employers. And so as you think about that number, that's a lot. And this year, there is some transitional relief that the employers have some room to get it right this year. They can cover 70% of their population versus 95. And that gives us the year to say to our employers, do not wait. You need to learn and know how to do this. Because you don't want to be the year where it's at 95% and you don't know how to offer to 95% and face penalties.
And so from your perspective, it is the law. It's the current law. And for now, people should be preparing on how do I deal with this? Businesses should be taking the same tact. How do I deal with this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we spend, I would tell you, significant amount of our time now with our employers walking through this.
Jolie, you were talking about the counting, measuring, and reporting part that's going to become part that's coming up in January. What exactly is involved with that, and how can employers best set themselves up to deal with that?
Well, I think a couple of things. I mean, there are technically two separate kinds of reporting. One which is going to apply to applicable large employers. The other one which is going to apply to insurers and self-insured plans. As I can't remember if Valerie or David mentioned, but you know, the government has given us some guidance on this, but it is not all finalized. We have some draft forms. It has been, you know, streamlined to some degree, but this is still going to be a resource burden on, you know, even the largest of employers. They're going to be tracking, you know, in any given month, you know, who is eligible for coverage? Was it made available to them? You know, things along those lines, again, which are geared toward helping the government get the information that it needs to enforce both the employer mandate and the individual mandate. I think one of the most critical pieces that any employer has to consider is whether or not they have the ability to do this in-house or whether they need to tap into a third party, a payroll company, a consultant, to assist with tracking that information and going forth with the reporting. I think Valerie mentioned there are penalties associated with not doing this, particularly in the first year. The government does provide some relief for what we'll call good faith efforts. But much like other aspects of the ACA, where an employer simply chooses not to, they're just not going to do it, you can face, you know, potentially very stiff penalties of, I believe it's up to $100 per information return. Up to, I think, $1.5 million, you know, in a year. So, you know, this is another aspect which, you know, is not going to be a favorite for employers. It is one more thing for them to do among many things they have to do. But it is one that needs to be taken seriously, and they need to consider internal resources and whether or not they need to go external to get the assistance they need to complete this.
You know, and I think it's interesting to point out, and this is something sort of background for everybody, realize we had a one-year delay of the employer mandate in the Affordable Care Act. The real reason we had a one-year delay of the employer mandate is because this piece, this collection of information from employers who was offered employees were offered qualified affordable coverage was not in place. The service, to their credit, spent 12 months attempting to try to get to a place that actually allowed us to deliver that information easily. It's a lot of information. And the challenge with it being a lot of information is, regardless of how it happens, if it delayed the law for an entire year, now employers are dealing with it. Inevitably, they're going to have some complexities and challenges. And Julie's 100% correct, is that you have to look as an employer and figure out, am I going to do this? Am I going to get help to do this?
It's complicated, isn't it, Valerie? I mean, there's a lot of complexities to this law that have to be considered.
Right. And I would tell you, in this area, as we work with our clients, you keep peeling the onion. And every layer, there's something else. So, for instance, if you need to count someone and all of a sudden you find, like in a school district where we have a lot of school districts, you have a bus driver who then does the weekend Saturday games, or the substitute who is under the ESC, or they a substitute on your payroll. All of these things are starting to happen where people are saying, wow, I need to change that terms of employment. And so that's the biggest impact you're going to see with the employers is, you know what? We're going to cut you at 30 hours. We're going to track you to this. We're not going to let you do these other pieces, or we might have to hire someone new. There's a lot of that that is going on that is affecting individual efficiencies and a work environment.
After the break, we'll continue our conversation about what employers need to know about the Affordable Care Act. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Join the conversation at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Employers have a lot to think about as they navigate the Affordable Care Act. And here with advice on how to do that are Julie Havens with Voorhees, Sater, Seymour & Pease, Valerie Bogdan-Powers with Horan, and David Whaley from Dinsmore & Shule. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Valerie, I take it that many businesses have been preparing for this ahead of time, but for those who haven't, is it too late? Is there anything they can do at this point to get caught up and with these changes that are coming in just a few months?
So we like to believe it's never too late. But as we tell employers and the choices they're making, at the end of the day, if you choose to offer insurance or not is what we term as pay or play. There is just one big macro fine. So at the end of the day, if someone chooses not to be in the game right now, they are going to pay $2,000 per employee minus 30. That's the official. There's some transitional relief in the upcoming year. And so that formula is, here's the worst thing you could do. The employers that, again, we work with offer insurance. They're working through the nuances. The challenge that is facing the industry is groups like hospitality, nursing homes, where they have a very large part-time workforce that maybe weren't offered benefits, staffing agencies. And they're the ones struggling the most because the ability to pull that amount of people onto their plan is unaffordable. And they don't know how to pass those costs on to the business. Yet to not offer is a huge penalty given the amount of people. And I would say that's probably the group of our employee base that is really struggling with where can they go from an affordability standpoint.
Yeah, and you said part-time employees, and I always think that's interesting because we had this employer definition of part-time employees, which was the employer would call and say, I have a part-time employee. Now we have a very, very standard definition of what a part-time employee is. And since we have a very standard definition, we have a uniformity across all employers, across all industries, trying to figure out how to take that class of people who generally the marketplace thought of as part-time employees, thought as of individuals who were not benefit eligible, and now saying these individuals are largely, at least for healthcare purposes, benefit eligible. And since they're benefit eligible, you need to modify your systems and however you modify your systems to try to get these individuals coverage so as to avoid penalties for you, the employer.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. Let's talk with Hirsch in Cincinnati. Good afternoon. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you.
What's your question?
It's not a question. It's
more of a comment.
The comment is basically that we have an awful lot of insurance accountants, insurance consultants, and insurance benefits people who are really well employed by a very complex and much more overly complex system than any other country in the Western world. And the question is, do you think it will be better for small businesses, like every other country in the world, to have a much more simplistic tax-based health insurance product program that would guarantee coverage for all and not require so many loopholes, so many hurdles, and such a intense bureaucracy, which is what we have actually created in spite of the fact that we have expanded coverage for many people.
A good comment, Hirsch. Anybody want to field that one?
Yeah, I mean, we hear this a lot, and I always sort of step everybody back and say that there are functionally only three ways to deliver healthcare in an industrialized world. You have a tax-preferred way. If we think about that, we'll give you individuals some tax break for the amount of money you spend on healthcare. It's your responsibility, and we, the government, are not dealing with the major parts of how that program are sold. We have a secondary space, the space we're in where it's an employer-individual sort of work-together system, but that leads to some oddities, and we have a government involvement with respect to the products themselves, and we have these what I call sticks and carrots to people and sticks and carrots to employers to offer coverage. The third is this Medicare for All idea. It's a single-payer system. And it's interesting because when you really boil down the ideas, there's only one of those three. I don't see us going to a tax savings only plan. It seems that that probably ends up increasing healthcare cost. We're kind of stuck in the middle with where we have this push or play. And then on the other side, we have a Medicare for All, which seems politically uninhabitable. And so I think we're kind of stuck in this space in the middle where we have sticks and carrots to people, sticks and carrots to employers, and a facilitated marketplace to try to purchase insurance in the middle. Now, I always do say, and I think this is really important, we're moving to a defined contribution program, an account-based like program. Let's imagine you had the old school 1970s pension plan. We'll pay you a $2,000 per month for the rest of your life. Well, we had that in the late 1970s and the 1980s. We've moved to an account-based plan. We'll give you money to your account. You invest it. Well, we functionally had a defined benefit-based healthcare system. We, employer, will provide you healthcare. And we're moving to this defined contribution individual theory. You, individual, why don't you go out and participate in the market and solve your problems? Pick what works best for you. The challenge is we haven't yet created a good enough vehicle to allow employers to throw money in that bucket to help you find what works for you. And if I were to sort of design my own program, if I were king for the day, I think I would create more of a healthcare IRA world where employers could get rid of their obligations, their mandates, by throwing money into a bucket and letting you, individual, go buy whatever suits you best.
And it's interesting with that because you're starting to see from the consumer, the individual, your audience is going to have to play a different role with healthcare. And I'm not sure everyone's awake to that. And so you're going to have to learn to shop it. You're going to have to learn the real cost of insurance. And you're going to have to learn how to utilize really the providers and the hospital systems differently. And you're going to start seeing different things that come as a result. But I think that's one of the biggest pieces as, you know, we send people to what we call exchanges, a big word, exchange. But what it is it's a way for a consumer to make a decision around the healthcare they want to purchase in a way that matches their belief on finances and their belief on healthcare. That's where the world's going to be continuing to go. And I think it links, David, to your defined contribution. Here's how much money I'm willing to give you for insurance. But, you know, most people pay about $500 for insurance. And the actual cost is $6,000 annually. So there's a whole gap in terms of what people pay and what actually is what they're being charged in the system that is going to have to be part of that gap that gets closed for the consumer as they become better consumers.
So, Jolie, what's your take on this? Do we see more and more self-funding by employers? Do we see health savings accounts becoming more common, especially as we have plans that have larger deductibles attached to them?
Well, I certainly do see a lot of health savings account, high deductible health plan, you know, combos on the employer side. And to go with what David and Valerie are talking about, I certainly do see the defined contribution concept bearing out with several employers where they will say, okay, employee, we're going to give you $250 a month. You can choose among, let's say, three plan options that the employer provides. One, which may be largely paid for by that employer subsidy. You could get a medium one in which the employer subsidy doesn't pay all of it, but may pay a lot of it. Or you can get a richer benefit, which is more expensive, and the employer can pony up the difference. The other thing I would mention is, you know, I agree with David that I think as much as employers could eventually get out of this and just say, this is the amount of money that we're going to give, you, the individual, take responsibility for your health care and you select the plan that's best for you. I think, frankly, that makes sense. But interestingly, the government has, in a couple of different ways, told us that, they are not ready for employers to do that. They have told us we can't have standalone HRAs. So we can only have health reimbursement accounts now, which are tied to medical plans sponsored by the employer. So the employer can't simply put money in this HRA and then allow the individual to go use that to buy individual coverage. They've also clarified, even outside of the HRA context, that the employer does not have the ability to provide tax-free money to their employee for the employee to go out and purchase individual coverage. That's a question that we get all the time, and I think is tied to some of the discussion in the marketplace regarding there being a potential loophole allowing for that. And, you know, just even a couple of days ago, the government came out and said, no, there is no such loophole. You employers are not permitted to provide tax-free dollars and then have your employees go out and purchase individual coverage. So those are a lot of the questions that we are getting on that particular topic these days.
David, one of the things with larger deductibles, though, can an employer craft an incentive plan around the larger deductible and say, hey, employee, if you stay healthy and do these things, we'll help pay for some of your out-of-pocket expenses?
Well, you know, we end up having a lot of wellness programs, and it's intriguing because it's been a very, very we're going to call it a newsworthy past week. The EEOC actually filed a complaint a week and a half ago against a wellness program, saying that functionally the wellness program benefit was too big and it discriminated against people who were unhealthy. And so we really have this sort of push-pull regulatory arbitrage space with respect to wellness programs. The type of program you explained, Mark, is a type of program that can likely work underneath IRS guidance and Department of Labor guidance and Health and Human Service guidance. But then we have the EEOC on the other side literally litigating against those type of plans and programs. And so we have some regulatory arbitrage or some miscommunication among the regulatory industry or agencies to really sort of push inside of a wellness idea and philosophy. That's really putting employers in an odd space because they would like to ask their employees, they would like to ask the spouses of employees and the children of employees to participate in their own health and well-being. If those individuals participate in their own health and well-being, we end up on an overall basis lowering healthcare costs, making life better, people more productive. And then we have the EEOC coming in and saying, yeah, but what you're really doing is discriminating against people who have disabilities. So we have this mixed message bag, and it's a challenge from an employer perspective because you're trying to figure out what's the next best step without actually stepping yourself into some legal liability.
And I think in our, it's interesting as we work with employers, that's what we would call an outcome-based plan where based on what we consider chronic conditions that you're controlling those conditions. And you're right. There's a lot of litigation that's starting to happen. We also look at a lot of employees and say there's a way to do wellness that focuses on preventive. For instance, you know, we'll contribute to your HSA if you go get an annual physical. It's part of your plan. It's covered 100%. And it's a great and important to have a relationship with your primary care to get into any of disease states or know really where your health lies. And so those are some of the ways for groups that don't want to go so much on the edge that they'll go more in that direction, which we don't see litigation there, but maybe David and Jolie do. But we haven't seen that yet in terms of preventive care, especially linked to what we would consider more rewards.
Valerie, how is the ACA altering how businesses go out and shop for health coverage now? It has to be having a profound effect, I would think.
Mm-hmm. I would split the large market with the small group market. And right now in Ohio, that splits at 50 employees. It'll be in 2016 at 100. For the large group markets, you're seeing a lot more mid-market, as you say, the self-funded. They're still shopping the same. They're still usually typically going through a consultant, looking at their fully insured options, looking at their self-funded options, still working with the carriers. In the small group market, what's changing is the introduction of community rating. And what community rating has said is before you were underwritten based on your performance as a company and the performance of the overall pool. Going forward, you are now underwritten via four factors, which is gender, geography, smoking status, and I'm going to forget the fourth. David and Jolie can help me. But it's no longer under the performance of how your health statuses. It's on these factors. And so what's happening is it's really creating a pool where costs are spread between the high risk and the low risk groups. So if you're a high risk group and you had high claims as a company, you're pretty excited about the community rating option. If you're a group with a lot of 26-year-old males, you really don't want to be in that pool because you have very low claims, very low incidences. So you're seeing a lot of those groups trying to get out of the fully insured market, trying to change their plan years, trying to go to self-funded, or maybe not even staying in insurance.
And I think it's important. I always like to remind the audience or anybody I'm talking with the difference between fully insured and self-funded. Mm-hmm. Fully insured is when you pay a premium to an insurer and they take all the risk of loss. If everybody in the plan runs up $4 million of claims, then that is all on the insurer. Self-funded is actually where the employer participates inside of the risk of loss. And so if everybody goes and has $4 million of claims, the employer's out quite a bit of money. But to stop that, to protect that from the employer, we actually have stop-loss policies that are written into those insurers that say, hey, once a claim gets above $50,000, $100,000, we, the stop-loss carrier, will pick it up. Or once the plan has more than $250,000 in claims, we, the stop-loss carrier, will pick it up. But interestingly, we had guidance last week that was actually coming into the marketplace to start talking about some of these laws that are going to regulate the self-insured market, the stop-loss policies. Because what's happening is a lot of these stop-loss policies are getting written with what we call attachment points, the place where they start to pay. At such low levels, they really look like fully insured insurance.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, because you will hear talk more now of smaller employers becoming self-insured. And I think that is potentially only true to a point for the exact reason that David mentioned, which is if you have a very, very low attachment point, it's hard to say that, at least in the traditional sense, that you are a self-insured employer, because you are not accepting very much risk as a part of that structure.
Jolia, is it possible that the ACA means the end of workplace health plans at some point, as more and more businesses opt to pay the penalty as opposed to paying the insurance for their employees?
I mean, I suppose it could. I don't know that any of us can predict necessarily where this is all going to end up, especially now that, the ACA is headed back to the Supreme Court again. What I will say, though, is that we are not seeing employers actually pulling out. You know, there was a lot of talk around the time the ACA was enacted as to whether the real intent of the administration was to create, a single-payer system and make it so difficult for employers to comply that they were simply going to pull out. But that is not what we are seeing in the market. What we are seeing, though, are employers considering strategies to mitigate potential cost increases of bringing on this new, formerly known as part-time population. And there are a host of strategies that can be employed there. One that is being considered is having the employer offer the coverage but not subsidize it. So what that does is that takes you outside of the highest penalty that Valerie described, and then has you paying potentially a lesser penalty of $3,000 annually for those employees who go to the exchange and get the subsidy. And that's where the issue with the Supreme Court case comes back in. If subsidies aren't available in a given state because you have a federally facilitated exchange, then an employer within that state, and Ohio does have a federally facilitated exchange, could never be the subject of a penalty. This all really is very intertwined, and there are so many moving parts, but what happens in one area really does have a ripple effect throughout. I guess what I would say I'm seeing is not employers choosing to get out of the game, but looking for strategies to mitigate costs, of which the one that I described is but one of those types of strategies.
David?
Yeah, and I always like to harken back to Massachusetts. Massachusetts was sort of the forefather of this type of system, the sticks and carrots system. They enacted the Massachusetts Healthy Families Act, I think it was called, in 2006. And so we have a history, a window to look at that. In Massachusetts, about 70% of the population gained coverage through their employment at the time of the enactment of the law. And in 2011, about 71% of the population gathered coverage through their employment. Now, during the same window of time, about 68% of Americans gathered their coverage through employment, and that dropped to 58%. So what we see is actually from Massachusetts, maybe actually an increase in employer-provided coverage when we would otherwise think that maybe it results in a decrease. I think that Jolie's 100% right, correct, though. It's the question of how an employer participates, not necessarily whether they will or will not participate.
And just, Mark, one other point on that. As you think about it, employers were not required before healthcare reform to offer insurance, yet 80% of employees or 80% of individuals get their insurance through employers on a national basis. And so if you think about that, what keeps an employer in today's world to leave insurance is – the cost has gotten so high and that the market now has guaranteed issue individual policies that would allow individuals to get a better offering outside of their group plan based on where the costs have gone. And that's what we've seen. And we've had less than one hand of my clients drop insurance, and they're all very small employers who have onesies, twosies, who literally said it's better for us to go on the exchange than to keep this group plan because we're a very small business. We have not seen any migration above a very small employer.
Jolie, Valerie, and David, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Jolie Havens, partner with Voorhees, Sater, Seymour & Pease, Horan, Vice President of Employee Benefits Services, Valerie Bogdan-Powers, and David Whaley, partner at Dinsmore & Shohl. After the break, Thane Maynard talks with the man best known as the father of the global green building movement about his latest book, Explosion Green. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.